Hello, and welcome to Around It About Chattanooga. I am your host, Michael Edward Miller. Today, we are talking about a new book. It's nonfiction. It's a collection of first-person accounts of Cherokee history. Carolyn Ross Johnston is the editor. The book is Voices of Cherokee Women. It includes letters, diaries, and personal interviews, some from the Trail of Tears, some from the Civil War, and some from the modern era. It even includes love letters between John Ross and his wife, Mary. These are fascinating glimpses into history. Carolyn Ross Johnston, welcome to Around It About.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're a professor. You teach history at Eckerd College in Florida. Is this your fifth book? Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
And do you prefer Dr. Ross Johnston, or how do you like to be addressed?
Any way you're comfortable addressing me.
The book is part of the Real Voices, Real History series from your publisher, John F. Blair. It's Cherokee history from the point of view of real women who lived it. I think the book is pretty unusual because of that. How frequently does a book like this come out, history, specifically Cherokee history, from the perspective of people who were actually there?
I think it's relatively rare to have a book of primary sources about Cherokees. There have been a few, for example, one by Theda Perdue, and there's some others that I can think of that have various selections. But this one is the first one that I know of on Cherokee women.
And I think it would appeal to a scholarly audience, but it seems like it's aimed at a popular audience, just the average reader, not necessarily somebody who's a history scholar.
Well, I would hope that a lot of people who are scholars, also who are educated people, who have an interest in Cherokee women and in Cherokee history or in local history, would find it engaging. Because as you read it, you really are moved by their testimonies about their lives and about their experiences. For example, this fall is the 175th anniversary in commemoration of the Trail of Tears.
Right.
And it's one thing to read about it. It's yet another to hear the voices of people who actually experienced it.
Going back to the earliest encounters between Cherokees and Europeans, in the book you say that Europeans were shocked by the amount of sexual freedom and political and economic power Cherokee women had. What was so shocking back in the 1500s when Europeans first encountered Cherokees?
As you said, they were shocked, one, because they weren't Christians. They were shocked because the women had so much power. The women were the farmers and the men the hunters, and they had tremendous political power. They were shocked that the women could obtain divorce easily, that they had sexual freedom. Of course, this was very different from the European situation in the 16th century, and that's why they thought that they were uncivilized.
Yeah.
And they set out immediately to change all of that and to turn the men into the farmers and the women into the homemakers, keep them out of the fields, and also to try to work on having them adopt patriarchal family values.
Well, it's interesting because you've got some accounts from some missionaries, some of their own letters and diaries. You've reprinted them in the book. How did it go for these missionaries trying to force the Cherokees to become accustomed to a totally different set of values?
Well, you probably know that right down the road here at Brainerd was one of the most famous missions in the 19th century.
Yeah.
It was started in 1817, and I've read those papers of the missionaries that are at Harvard now at the Houghton Library, and they wrote very extensively about these attempts to try to convince the women to adopt European values and Christianity. About 10% of the Cherokee tribe did convert to Christianity, so for them, they were successful in changing their attitudes in many respects, but 90% by the beginning of the Trail of Tears still remained very traditional. Or if they did convert to Christianity, quite frequently, they didn't think that they would have to forsake their old kind of ceremonies. And so when they found that out, sometimes they would have to cross their name off the roll.
Wow. So they would have kind of a hybrid of both belief systems.
Very much so. And even today, I mean, the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma and the Eastern Band of Cherokee still retain a great number of their ceremonies, of their rituals, and their beliefs, in fact. And so they don't see them in conflict.
And something I don't think I really realized until I read this book, the Trail of Tears was not the end of this by any means. That in 1889, the book talks about the federal government's efforts to assimilate the Cherokees. I want to read a short excerpt from the book on that. This is in 1889. This is after the Trail of Tears. What I'm about to read is from an official federal government report. This is official government policy in 1889. The report of the Commissioner of Indian Affairs on October 1st, 1889, presented the federal government's policy of allotment, and it says, "The Indians must conform to the white man's way, peaceably if they will, forcibly if they must. They must adjust themselves to their environment and conform their mode of living substantially to our civilization." This is the federal government literally saying to the Cherokees, you have to live our way. I mean, that just blew my mind that it was that blatant.
It was very blatant. And in fact, as you read the selections in the Voices of Cherokee Women, you see this arc in which the Cherokees were under tremendous pressure to become assimilated and civilized or to be killed. And the different crises tested this all the way through the 19th century. So at the time when they had to leave their homes, in fact, at this time of the year, in a bitter winter, to go on the 800-mile walk, essentially, for all of them, they were able in Oklahoma to rise phoenix-like and rebuild. But just at the point they had rebuilt, and they had lost a fourth of the members of the tribe, either before, during, or after the Trail of Tears, who died. When they got to Indian Territory and rebuilt, then along came the Civil War, which completely devastated their country. And then after the Civil War, because the nation had split over the issue of slavery, because they had slaves, they were punished along with all the other tribes in Indian Territory. The federal government abrogated all of their treaties, forced the railroads through. And in fact, John Ross, who was the principal chief from 1828 to 1866, was still negotiating for the Cherokee Nation on his deathbed. He died in 1866. And just as they got through the crisis of the Civil War, as you suggest, was the allotment period. So the idea of the allotment was to take the land that they had been supposedly given in exchange for the land in the East, sell it, give the Cherokees a small portion, like 60 acres per member of the family, and therefore essentially take all the rest of the land from them and put that money in trust, which they didn't see all of the money, even into the 20th century. And the important thing about that, and as you said about trying to assimilate them to the U.S. way, was that it broke up their communal ownership of land,
right?
Which was devastating.
It's described kind of as a socialistic system, what they used to have.
It was very much geared towards being able to have no poor within the nation, nobody who had any kind of want in that sense, because the land was communally held. But your farm or your improvements, if you were a Cherokee member of the nation, was personal property. But in terms of the whole, and when you break that up, then you're damaging the integrity of the culture very, very seriously. So it very much destabilized everything. So that by the time Oklahoma became a state in 1907, Indian religion was outlawed, Indian communal property was devastated. So it really is a miracle to see how both kinds of parts of the nation, the Eastern Band and the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma, have survived beautifully, have retained their culture. It's been very rough. But it wasn't until the New Deal and John Collier and the New Deal for Indians that Indian religion could be practiced, that they could speak their languages, because that was also forbidden at the schools, the Indian boarding schools.
Yes. If you're just joining us, I'm talking to Carolyn Ross Johnston. Her book is Voices of Cherokee Women. It's Cherokee history from ancient to modern times, focusing on the female perspective. In the book, you talk about kind of the narrative arc of the history of Cherokee women having the power originally, losing it, and then towards the end, in the modern times, they regain it. You've got two female principal chiefs of the Cherokee Nation. What happened? How did they come back into power in our time in the 80s, the 90s?
I think the reason they began to come back into power was that they never really lost power.
Interesting.
In the sense that they lost constitutional power in 1827, and they lost a lot of political influence. But within the families, they still had tremendous influence and power. And if you look at the wonderful rise of Wilma Mankiller and Joyce Dugan, they were able, during the 1960s and 70s, to be engaged in community organizing through the War on Poverty. And they rose into leadership positions. And so when Ross Swimmer had the opportunity to appoint someone as a temporary chief, when he had another appointment, he appointed Wilma Mankiller. And then she won on her own in 1987.
And she was the first ever.
I mean, women were not chiefs anyway in the Cherokee Nation.
Yeah.
They had a lot of political power, but formally the men were the chiefs. And then Joyce Dugan in 95 was elected in the Eastern Band. And so, as you say, the arc within the book is that they had equality when they first met the Europeans. And then they began to lose power in various ways until the 20th century, in which they're the ones who became highly educated, for example, at the female seminary
Yes. In
Tahlequah. They're the ones. To explain this rise to power, you have to look at education for both women and men, but also the ways in which they were so dedicated to their communities so that then they were able in a more formal way. So, you know, we talk about power as public power and private power. They never lost that private power, but they were ready to serve when they were asked to in these more public ways.
You were born in Georgia. You're kind of from this area. You grew up in Cleveland somewhat. Tell me a little bit about that.
I found that Cleveland was a very exciting place to grow up. I was in the middle school, I guess you'd call now, the junior high school when I came. And so I went all the way through high school in Bradley County. And as opposed to some other areas, you know, this was surrounded by Indian sacred sites.
Yes.
But I didn't know it at the time.
Really?
No, not a thing. In fact, when I was in high school, I won a contest for the VFW. And as a result of that, James Corn, who was a historian, who was one of the ones who got Red Clay recognized, gave me a book that was called Rattlesnake Springs and Red Clay. That's the first thing I ever heard about Cherokee history.
Wow.
The whole time that I was growing up in Cleveland. Then my uncle E.L. Ross discovered that we had a Cherokee ancestor, Caledonia. And he had told us that, you know, people thought we were related to John Ross, but we weren't directly related to John Ross. My mother was a Ross. But we were related to him through Scotland and another brother.
Yeah, because John Ross, I think maybe people don't realize this, he was Scottish as well as Cherokee.
He was 1/8 Cherokee because his father was Scottish and his mother's part Cherokee. And he was one of the founders of Chattanooga.
Yes.
As you know, in 1816, he had at Ross's Landing a warehouse, a trading post, and a ferry. He also had a house in Rossville, a very fine house, which he was thrown out of with his family
Yeah. In
the dead of winter. And a lottery owner of a number had somehow, illegally, of course, but the state had given his house to this lottery winner. His cabin is now in Bradley County that he had to go to during that time. But so he's really a founder of Chattanooga.
I don't think he ever came back to Chattanooga after he left and was forced to go out to Oklahoma. What do you think, if he were around today, if he could see everything that's changed at the Ross's Landing area, downtown Chattanooga, the waterfront, what do you think he would say about all this?
I think he would be touched by the fact there's a memorial at Ross's Landing, which was not there for so many years. I think that he would also be very impressed by the vitality and the growth of this city. He would also think, so this is why they forced us out of our homes and our lands to build this. So there would be a sadness there also,
yeah,
and a homesickness for the land where for thousands of years the ancestors lived. So I think that it would be a bittersweet return.
Your book is Voices of Cherokee Women. How can the listeners find it?
It's available on Amazon at John F. Blair, at Barnes & Noble, and so it's very readily available.
Carolyn Ross Johnston, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.